customers and expand broadband access and so much more. But Madam President,
that's Democratic Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock's excerpt of a powerful speech from the floor of the Senate Tuesday, as he called on conservative members of his own party to stop obstructing voting rights legislation. Reverend Warnock is also pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, which was the spiritual home of Dr. Martin Luther King and his father. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. You can go to democracynow.org for all of our shows, and also check us out on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. I'm Amy Goodman. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end of year drive, it's the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $45,000 by December 31st, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000. Thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund for the Oregon Community Foundation. Double the impact of your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Fred Meyer, a QFC workers' strike in the Portland metro area. State health officials face grim projections of an Omicron surge. And the Portland Housing Authority lags behind the rest of the state in giving out needed emergency housing vouchers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 17, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem. Starting at 6 a.m. this morning, Fred Meyer and QFC workers in the Portland metro area went on strike, saying they face unfair and unsafe working conditions. Grocery workers in Newburgh, Klamath Falls, and Bend are also on strike. The workers are represented by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. The union says that workers overwhelmingly voted in favor of going on strike, as they've tried to negotiate a contract extension with the two grocery stores. The workers plan to strike for a week, picketing in Portland at a different store location each day until Christmas. Union leaders say they're pushing for better health care, worker safety, and fair wages. A statement from the local says, quote, Fred Meyer's callous disregard for their essential workers is stunning, considering the sacrifice these employees have made throughout the pandemic. While so many were able to stay safely in their own homes, essential grocery workers showed up to work, helping feed our communities. These employers should recognize their sacrifice by treating these workers with the basic respect they deserve, end quote. Fred Meyer says it will keep its doors open and has been accused of illegally hiring replacement workers to fill in. The first cases of the Omicron variant in Oregon were detected this week, and scientists warned that it will be the dominant variant in the state by mid-January. Oregon researchers have looked to other places around the country and around the world to understand how Omicron will impact the population. So far, experts agree that Omicron is more contagious than the Delta variant, though it's possible that it may not cause as severe an infection. Even so, there will be a significant impact on the healthcare system. Health officials are imploring Oregonians to get booster shots when they are available, wear masks in public, and keep their gatherings small. Governor Kate Brown held a press conference with state health officials today to discuss strategies to address the expected surge. Dr. Peter Graven is a lead data scientist at OHSU's Business Intelligence Unit. Dr. Graven creates projections of what different variants will look like as they arrive in Oregon. He spoke about the severity of his new predictions.
I'd hoped to be able to share better news today, but today's forecast is going to anticipate another surge of severe illness in Oregon. Like many of you, I had seen that the infections had been increasing strongly in other places. And this week we learned that there are hospitalizations that are coming with it. While the severity is less, it is not low enough to prevent us from seeing hospitalizations. Data from the UK and Denmark that have similar immune profiles to Oregon indicates that Omicron is reducing immunity by roughly half. That means people who thought they were protected are no longer protected in the same way. Since the first cases were detected there 3 weeks ago, it is now doubling every 2 to 3 days in those countries and will soon be the dominant strain. Although the rate of severe illness does appear to be lower than with previous variants, we see that unfortunately causing some severe illnesses in hospitalizations in the UK and Denmark. If we match that up to Oregon, where we see our first date of our first case and try to match theirs, we can expect a surge in Oregon hospitalizations by mid-January with infections that begin sooner than that. Combined with its heightened transmissibility, we expect Omicron will generate a large increase in the number of Oregonians who will become severely ill and likely need a hospital bed. It is different this time. The lengths of stay are lower. The need for ICU or ventilators is less, but people will be needing the hospital, and we are preparing for that surge. By the time we reach a peak, we do unfortunately expect the number of hospitalized Oregonians could eclipse the number from Delta surge in September.
That was OHSU data scientist Dr. Peter Graven. Omicron can infect people who are vaccinated, including healthcare workers, which raises concerns about hospital capacities. The severity of the Omicron variant in other states also impacts hospitalizations in Oregon. Dr. Renee Edwards is the chief medical officer at OHSU. She described the forecasting of Omicron's impact as a, quote, gut punch, end quote, for healthcare workers already stretched thin for 2 years. Here are some of her remarks.
This news of another surge is particularly disappointing because we're just starting to emerge from the Delta variant and beginning to turn our attention to the patients whose procedures and other medical care were postponed to accommodate patients extremely sick with COVID-19. Oregonians are already presenting with more acute illnesses as a result of delaying care during the pandemic. And we're facing a considerable backlog of necessary delayed surgeries. You likely have heard the Delta variant surge described as a surge of the unvaccinated. Although there is much we don't yet know about the Omicron variant, we do know, as Dr. Graven explained, that it can infect fully vaccinated individuals, especially those who have not yet received their booster shot. The good news is that fully vaccinated and especially boosted people are much less likely to develop severe disease. I'm sharing this information with you to emphasize a critically important point. It's not too late to protect yourself and those you care about from becoming gravely ill or even dying from COVID-19. Dr. Graven and other forecasters are showing us what is coming. And now we must double down on following the measures that we know will keep us as safe as possible. If you haven't already done so, please get vaccinated. It is the single most important thing you can do to protect yourself and those around you. And ensure that your eligible children are vaccinated as soon as you possibly can. If your last vaccine was at least 6 months ago, you're eligible for a booster. Please get this shot right away. According to Dr. Graven's forecast, we have about 2 or 3 weeks before the surge begins, and it takes 2 weeks for the booster shot to become fully effective. So the time to act is now. We know that getting boosted, wearing a mask, physically distancing, avoiding large gatherings and using hand hygiene are still the very best ways to prevent severe illness and death from COVID-19. We simply cannot continue to see people die unnecessarily from this illness.
That was Dr. Renee Edwards, the Chief Medical Officer at OHSU. Governor Kate Brown says additional resources to distribute booster shots will be made available to health providers next week, since it's crucial to get as many people boosted as possible before the peak of Omicron hits. There isn't a shortage of booster doses, but rather a shortage of staff to help administer them. Oregon residents are encouraged to find vaccine and booster information and appointments at getvaccinatedoregon.gov. Federal officials made extra emergency housing assistance available to counties in June, but Portland's Housing Authority has only distributed 3% of them. Willamette Week first reported the discrepancy between how many vouchers the agency, Home Forward, got and how many it had given out. Home Forward serves all of Multnomah County, and they received 476 vouchers. They've used only 15. The vouchers are essentially cash for rent, and it's designed to help houseless people, those fleeing domestic or dating violence, and people with unstable housing. Elsewhere in Oregon, about 60% of housing vouchers have been distributed over the last 6 months, compared with 3% in Multnomah County. Home Forward says the slow pace of distribution was because of referrals, staffing shortages, and the different circumstances that the county experienced. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden actually pushed for the inclusion of the housing vouchers in the American Rescue Plan. A spokesperson says he is, quote, deeply displeased, end quote. They said in a statement, quote, those vouchers add lifelines for folks needing a roof over their head and a floor under their feet. This is urgent business throughout the year to prevent tragedies on the streets, and especially so now as temperatures drop with the onset of winter, end quote. Home Forward says they have identified the households who will receive the vouchers and are waiting to finish the process. A report on people's overall health by state gives Washington State mostly high marks, but the state continues to have a higher than average suicide rate. Eric Tegetoff takes a look at new research.
A new report provides a checkup on the health of people in Washington and the rest of the country. America's health rankings from the United Health Foundation assesses physical, mental, and social well-being and gives Washington State mostly high marks. But Dr. Ravi Johar, Chief Medical Officer at United Healthcare, notes the COVID-19 pandemic contributed to an uptick in deaths between 2019 and 2020 nationwide.
We had a 17% increase in death rate, and that 17% doesn't even reflect some populations. We know Hispanics and African Americans, the death rate was even higher than that.
The report says the pandemic contributed to 70% of the death rate increase. While Washington State received high marks for its low rate of premature deaths and percentage of low birth weight infants, it also continued to fare worse than the national average in areas like the suicide rate. Through 2019, Washington State also had a higher rate of suicide among young people, ages 15 to 19. Matt Cantor is with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI Washington. He says services related to suicide are mostly reactive.
It's a really sad story. Someone takes their own life. a community is impacted, and then the services start. The more proactive we are in engaging communities, the more you're going to see those incidents not even happen.
Cantor says it's also important for services to be culturally relevant for the young people they are helping, noting the suicide rate is especially high in indigenous communities across the country. Johar adds mental well-being is an important aspect of health.
Being able to have a support system, talking to friends, and finding a way to be socially active really, really makes a big difference in your mental well-being. And we know that mental well-being has a tremendous effect on physical well-being, too.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Vice President Harris is touting a new lead line removal plan in the Senate debate's voting rights legislation. With those stories and more, it's Jonah Chester with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
There is no reason in the 21st century for why people are still exposed to this substance that was poisoning people back in the 18th century.
Vice President Kamala Harris stopped by the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the AFL-CIO on Wednesday to unveil a new lead pipe and paint action plan. As part of that plan, the EPA is allocating $3 billion for lead pipe replacement efforts in 2022. Long-term, the initiative calls for replacing all of the nation's lead lines in the next decade. Harris calls it a job creator.
When union jobs are safer, our communities are safer. And when union members go to work, they go to work for all of us.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is pushing back on Democrats' plans to pass new voting rights legislation by year's end. The Hill reports the Dems are looking at altering the Senate's filibuster rules to break a months-long stalemate on the issue.
My colleagues across the aisle have pushed absurd bills that would do things like neuter voter ID laws, make every state legalize ballot harvesting, turn the Federal Election Commission into a biased partisan body, and even send taxpayer money to political campaigns.
Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar argues that Republican-controlled states have restricted voting access since the 2020 presidential election. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, as of early October, 19 states this year had adopted laws making it harder for folks to cast their ballots.
The Constitution anticipated that perhaps we would need a federal response when, in the words of the Constitution, as written by our founding fathers, that Congress can make or alter the rules regarding federal elections.
It's not all partisan gridlock, though. The Senate has unanimously passed a bill effectively banning imports from China's Xinjiang region, where the government is accused of forcing members of China's Muslim minority into labor camps. The act would only allow imports from the region if customs officials can prove the goods were made without the use of slave labor. And a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers has finalized a proposal to update the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein says the new version would extend numerous services to survivors of domestic violence.
Our agreement would also invest in prevention education efforts. It would expand access to emergency housing support for domestic violence supporters, and it would improve the health care response to sexual violence across the country.
Finally today, President Joe Biden signed a measure posthumously awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to the 13 U.S. service members who lost their lives during the Afghanistan evacuation in August. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 43 degrees, and tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1903, the Wright brothers make the first controlled, powered, heavier-than-air flight in the Wright Flyer in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. The quote of the day is from Orville Wright, who said, quote, "The airplane stays up because it doesn't have time to fall," end quote. Thank you. Charles Sams III is sworn in as the director of the National Park Service. He's the first Native American to hold the position. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonio Gonzalez. This week, Charles Sams III was sworn in as director of the National Park Service. He's the first Native American to hold the position. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent says tribal leaders reserve high hopes for his appointment.
Stephen Fasthorse is a councilman with the Northern Arapaho Tribe in Wyoming. He says when Charles Sams was confirmed by the Senate last month, it stopped him in his tracks. Still, he says, it was a long time coming.
Who better to be the stewards of the land than those to entrust in helping manage the lands than the original peoples of this land?
Fasthorse points out many of America's national parks contain land that's sacred to Native Americans, like in the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone. The federal government took many of these lands from tribal nations, and Sams has said he'll work to illuminate that history. He's also said he'll center the perspectives of Native Americans in his work. Fasthorse believes that includes placing a bigger focus on climate change and how it's transforming these special places. For National Native News, I'm Robin Vincent.
A big conference about the Colorado River wrapped up in Las Vegas Thursday. The river provides power and water to millions of people on farms, towns, and reservations across the West, including Colorado, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming. But the picture of the river isn't good right now. It's been hammered by a prolonged drought. Its two largest reservoirs are at their lowest levels on record. There was a lot of talk at the conference about increased collaboration between tribes and states along the Colorado, especially as officials begin negotiating new rules for managing the river next year. Tribes have been historically excluded from negotiations in the past. Dwight Lomiza is vice chairman of the Colorado River Indian Tribes in Arizona. He says his tribes do have a seat at the table this time around, but he's skeptical.
We're, you know, always a victim of a lot of promises, but no results. So that's been our history. So we're just going to It's kind of a wait and see right now.
The Colorado River Indian tribes have some of the most senior water rights along the river. And that story comes to us from Nate Hedgey at the Mountain West News Bureau. The Yurok tribe issued an emergency declaration this week in response to what it said was a spate of missing persons and attempted human trafficking incidents on the Northern California Reservation and in the town of Arcata, where it says there is a large number of cases involving missing and murdered indigenous women. Tribal Chairman Joseph L. James advised members to not go alone into town and to let family members know when they expect to return. The Yurok Tribal Court received reports from seven Yurok women over the last month who said they were approached by would-be traffickers. All made it to safety, but in October, one Hoopa woman, Emily Rising, went missing, and she has not been found. The Yurok and Hoopa Valley tribes are offering a $20,000 reward for information leading to her safe return. In New Mexico, the state Senate voted to redraw its own political districts Thursday, following hours of debate that centered on the priorities of a coalition of Native American tribes and pueblos. Source New Mexico reports the map put forth by the coalition represented a historic consensus that took months to reach. Members said it honored their growing voting power in state politics and right to self-determination. The map also drew two Hispanic Republican senators into the same district, which will require them to run against each other or move, or one of them must quit. The map the coalition supports, along with one introduced by Senator Linda Lopez and approved by the Senate, would also reduce the Hispanic majority Senate districts in the state from 16 to 15. Republican senators argued that the map is diluting Hispanic strength in favor of Native Americans. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
If you've been to the supermarket lately, chances are meat prices were higher. But family farm advocates say any profits aren't making their way to smaller cattle producers. They urge federal lawmakers to not let up on market concentration reform. Lawmakers from both sides of the political aisle have been calling attention to the issue that four companies are able to purchase and process roughly 80% of beef in America. Patty Lavera with the Campaign for Family Farms and the Environment says this is not a new problem, and that while ranchers and consumers are missing out, others are not.
Fewer companies run the middle of that food chain, and they're getting bigger, they have more control, and they keep more of the dollar.
At the federal level, the Biden administration recently announced a series of moves aimed at breaking up market consolidation, and several bills in Congress have been considered to address the problem. But Lavera says more urgency is needed, including immediately reinstating a requirement that meat processors adhere to country of origin labeling. A key industry group has pushed back against reform, saying it'll lead to unintended consequences for customers and producers. Backers of reform say prior to relaxed regulations, ranchers were paid much higher prices per animal, but they say that has dramatically declined since 2015, with more imported meat being sold in stores. In central South Dakota, rancher Nick Nemec says the lack of a viable market has made it harder for younger generations of his family to turn a profit.
I have a daughter and son-in-law who've been ranching with me now for 6 years and have kind of struggled to make ends meet because of cattle prices.
Nemec says he's been able to help them see through the lean years, but he fears other younger producers without family ties to farming might not be as lucky. The renewed calls for action follow a recent White House report showing that the larger meat processing companies are recording massive profits amid inflation issues in the economy. Industry leaders argue they're being made scapegoats by the situation. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
In the face of climate crisis, one retiree has renovated his home to produce more energy than it uses. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Lots of retirees take up projects around the house, like gardening, working on the car, or building a deck. But Steve Stevens of Golden, Colorado, has gone further than most. For 20 years, he's been renovating his 1979 ranch house to make it as energy efficient as possible. He started small by adding insulation in his attic.
And the house got to feel better. And my energy usage went down, and I got more and more ideas for stuff I could do.
He added thick insulation to his interior and exterior walls. He replaced windows, and he built vestibules at the entrances to the house, so people go through two doors to get inside.
That makes it so that you don't get drafts. You go in one, close it, and then you go in the next.
His need for heating and cooling plummeted, and a rooftop solar array now supplies the home's remaining energy needs. To save money, Stevens uses salvaged windows and doors, buys imperfect lumber, and does almost all the work himself.
So, a two-day job for a 25-year-old craftsman, I would spend a month on. That's fine. I don't have any deadlines.
He says he's motivated by thinking about the world his grandchildren will inherit and the need to protect it. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegetoff, Jonah Chester, Megan Kamrick, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, even if we don't see a written-out master plan, the banning of books, the attacks on teaching real U.S. history, the efforts to push out professors with views that transgress official U.S. policy, in their myriad forms, these actions tell us that it's important to powerful people to restrict what ideas people can access. It's the land of the free and the home of the brave, except if you want to know what's happened and happens here, or to tell people about it, well, it all shows us the power of ideas. As infuriating and sad and enervating as it all is, it reminds us that knowledge is power. So if you are someone who wants to know about the world, and if you aren't in a position to buy books to read, you might, as many of us did and do, go to the library. That's the place where you don't have to pay to sit down. You don't have to buy a book or a coffee in order to read. Libraries aren't just a meaningful reality, but also a meaningful symbol of the fact that there is a thing called the public interest. And it's a thing that the state, that thing we're all a part of, that we support with taxes,